Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Yes, good morning. Welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Grateful to be broadcasting from the unceded and ancestral territory of the Pulkamilam and Squamish speaking peoples. I'm Jesse, and welcome to the show. We have a very, very jam-packed show today. Four recorded pieces, and we'll have a live call-in. So unlike the usual pace of this show, which starts with some music and then builds up, we're just going to jump right into it. The first couple of pieces we're going to hear, or that you'll hear over the first half hour of the show, are with artists who are participating in IndieFest, which is happening, well, starting this Friday, November 15th to 23rd, over the next week or so, presented by Renaissance Opera. We're going to hear from Teya Kashihara, who is the star and co-creator of Eurydice Fragments, which kicks off the festival. But first, we will be hearing from Alexandra Caprara, who is the director and creator of Ultraviolets. And we talk all about it in this interview, so I will not waste any more time, and we will just get right into it.
My name is Alexandra Caprara. Most people call me Alex, and I am a former MFA of Simon Fraser's School of Contemporary Arts. I graduated last year, actually, and I am an interdisciplinary artist. I work primarily as a director, deviser, and also as a lighting designer. I'm originally from Toronto, Ontario, and I moved to Vancouver 3 years ago to pursue my MFA, and I've been lucky enough to work all around the world as an artist. And I primarily make work that is design-led and that focuses on interactivity between movement and design in particular. And yeah, my philosophy around what I do, I'm a queer artist and I believe in making work about queer joy, and that tells these stories and that uplifts our community. And what else can I tell you? I'm a Capricorn. What else do you want to know?
Well, that's a good start. There's lots to pull from right there immediately. The thing that just stuck in my mind immediately is when you say design-led. What does that mean for me and our listeners?
So a design-led creation process basically thinks of design as a holistic part of a process, and it's often a starting point when we're creating new work. So as a deviser, when I'm making work that is design-led, often the choreography or the story actually comes from that relationship that we're building to how we interact with design on stage. In particular, that often for me means working with lighting as a dance partner on stage and using that as a vehicle to reveal new ways of looking at movement. This is also something I do a lot with video as well in design-led processes, where there's a sense of interactivity between the design that's happening on stage that makes it not less of an aesthetic thing, but more of a participant in the work itself and sort of an extension of whatever ensemble or performance that you have on stages.
Right. So instead of the lighting or other parts of the design being supplements to whatever the work is, they actually become part of it, is the idea?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. You also mentioned a focus on queer joy in your works. Why is it important to focus and highlight queer joy?
I think that queer joy is the greatest form of resistance. I think especially after the past 2 days when things are incredibly dire. It is, in my opinion as an artist, more important than ever to make space for queer joy to happen and for queer spaces to take place in the theater and dance world. And so often the work that I write about is reflective of this idea of eliciting queer joy or just imbuing my processes with queer joy for my collaborators and myself. It's a simple answer, but I think that it's the most true to my work, and it's remained true for the past few years of my practice.
It's a big question. How do you come to art? I was going to ask, how do you come to dance and theater? But it seems bigger and more wide ranging than that. How does making art become part of your life?
Oh my God. I think that it is a part of your life. I think, and I hope I'm answering your question in the right way, but I think that I think to be an artist, everything you do is kind of like filtered through like your lens of like your work and the kind of ideas that you're percolating on. And I think it's impossible as artists to not move through life and respond with our work, like whether you're a writer or a dancer or a theater maker. And I think that's been true for myself in my own practice, that the art that I make and the art that, you know, I write about is so reflective of my own lived experiences and lived experiences of people close to me and responses to that. Is that kind of, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, totally.
Right. I hope I...
Yeah, if okay. There's, I don't think there's a wrong answer to that kind of question, right?
Yeah.
Because it is very personal.
Yeah.
That does segue into talking about the work that we're here to talk about, Ultraviolets. I was reading about it, and the piece I read about it is prefaced with a quote from Bell Hooks that yeah. says, queer not as being about who you're having sex with, that can be a dimension of it, but queer as being about the self that is at odds with everything around it and that has to invent and create and find a place to speak and thrive and to live. And mm-hmm. to me, that sounds like another way of saying what how you were just answering the question about where your work comes from. Do you find that in creating art or doing creative work that you are also sort of creating this space for yourself?
I think, yes, the space for myself, but I think with this work in particular, space for my community, I think that it's a non-singular process to make art, especially queer art that, like, You have to have this collective community mindset, especially in this work. We actually feature 10 members from the community that feature in the work as an added ensemble. And that quote in particular was so central to that, kind of encompassed how we thought about the work itself. But also, I think it's really reflective and personal to me. I love Bell Hooks's work. And for me, it's less about the idea necessarily of making art, but really like a way of being. And I guess by extension, a way of making art, but this idea that we can persist past any sort of adversity and find that place to live and to be abundant in our joy and to hold each other as a community. That's kind of where that piece resonates with me and kind of in the work Ultraviolets as well.
Great. Ultraviolets is playing Thursday, November 21st and Friday, November 22nd at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media. Can you give us a brief introduction or overview of what we might expect if we go to see Ultraviolets?
Yes, absolutely. Ultraviolets has been described as a big gay greenhouse disco. It's heavily inspired by disco and queer club aesthetics, but also really inspired by plant life and how that relates to queer history. And I don't want people to go in thinking they're going to see, you know, disco in the way that we think of it with like ABBA and like Studio 58. It is unrelated to that. We've really sort of contemporized this idea of what it means to think about disco in a queer club as a space for queer becoming to take place. So this greenhouse idea and this club idea have sort of been combined to create this place that queer people can live and be authentic and, you know, step into themselves on an individual level and on a community level. You can expect lots of haze, lots of disco balls in very unlikely places, strobe lighting, loud music. It's kind of like being in a club, but you're also following this ensemble of 15 people as they sort of jump cut between these ideas of what it means to become oneself on an individual level and on a communal level. And it's really fun. It's sort of, I don't want to give it away, but it is, it's very much kind of like being inside a club at times, and also at times quite like somber and intimate. And for me, it was about putting sapphic, in particular, sapphic intimacy on stage and queer joy on stage. And with that kind of also comes moments of queer, like, catharsis and community and anger and love. Yeah.
Great. And again, I don't want you to give it away, but on the surface, queer club culture and plant growth cycles don't live right beside each other necessarily, in my mind anyway. Mm-hmm. Can you elucidate that connection a little bit without giving the whole thing away?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a very rich history, and you look at the idea of plants that have been used as symbols for queer resistance and metaphors for queer love and queer experiencing. I think of lavender and lavender menace. I think of, you know, the green flower and also pansies. And so a lot of that relationship comes from that history and how it's married to queer history. But on a choreographic level and design level, this piece was actually devised studying both plant growth cycles and the ways that plants move, and also studying iconic disco and club dance styles. So the movement is actually reflective of these two very different things, and they're all really dramaturgically combined under this idea of queer becoming. And I think, to circle back to the Bell Hooks quote, plants throughout history have been acting as this sort of agent of persistence, regardless of what's happened in the world. There's always a way for plants to thrive and find new ways to live and to continue on despite what's happened. And that also feels true within queer history, and in particular in the persistence of queer people making spaces for this joy and this catharsis to take place. So that's kind of where those two levels intersect. So you can sort of see that visually in our movement, but also on a larger level in the way that these two ideas kind of are parallel and also sometimes intersecting. Yeah, that's what I would say. I did like, you know, a whole year's worth of like MFA research. So I'm trying to like par it down to like, I promise it connects, but yeah.
That's great. And I can see the parallels in terms of, you know, resilience and regrowth and rebuilding between queer culture and plant growth. You've mentioned a couple times queer becoming, and I think I can piece that together in my mind, but can you give us how you would define queer becoming?
I think queer becoming, and often people think it means like the becoming of a queer person or their journey of coming out. And that's actually, I'm glad you asked this, that's actually not how we define it, especially because though I really do think this audience, the audience that we're, you know, making the show for is for fellow queer audiences, but on a larger idea, to queer a sense of becoming is to abstract your own sense of becoming oneself. And anyone can relate to the idea of growing into yourself and stepping into what is true and authentic for yourself. And so queer becoming for me is like an intentional abstraction of what that heteronormative process looks like. And that's reflected in the work, both in the way that we actually see the body and how it interacts with light. We intentionally sort of skew people's perspectives and make things intentionally look strange. And a lot of that definition comes from Sarah Ahmed's work, Queer Phenomenology. It's just a simple idea of, again, an intentional abstraction of a thing that is considered one way. And then in doing that abstraction, you're revealing new ways to look at the thing. So for us, queer becoming is a new way of examining how people become oneself. And in this work, the answers to that are through a metaphoric exploration of germination, rot, and photosynthesis, which for us is sort of this idea of being able to step into yourself, being able to sort of speak to and honor all of the hard grief and the cathartic things that come with becoming, and also this idea of becoming through a sense of community and environment.
You mentioned, you know, doing a year of MFA research and doing your MFA at SFU, which is where I am currently. What is the process of taking something that is as academic as MFA research and turning it into a piece of art for public consumption?
For me, those processes felt, it's interesting because at times they felt very separate. You have the writing side of your MFA and then the art making side of your MFA. And I built this show with five undergraduate dancers that were also in the SFU program at the time, who knew a bit about my research because it was so hands-on. I gave them some of that reading and some of that insight into the academic side. And then we really just used it as a jumping off point to devise from. So the research has kind of always been there in the periphery of the work as inspiration for me and as sort of a guiding post of the things that I wanted to accomplish as an artist and as a designer. But really, in this remount, actually, it's been kind of nice to truly separate it from the requirements of an MFA. And also to, I think that my hope as an artist is that this work is accessible. And so it was important for me to create a work that, though inspired heavily by a bunch of this research, anybody could kind of come in and relate to it and access it. So yes, this version of the piece feels one step removed away from that research, but it, of course, is still so filled with all the many, many books I had to read and articles I had to read, which is great. But I think it's a thing that is maybe just for me to kind of have and not something that I think an audience needs to come into the work and understand it, if that makes sense.
Totally. And just touching on, you know, your hope that the work is accessible to the audience that comes, what broadly, what are your hopes for this work? What do you hope to accomplish, or what do you hope people take away from it?
Oh, I have so many hopes about this work. I mean, on the base level of these collaborators have brought in this community of dancers is that it creates visibility of queerness on stage and the diversity of what that looks like. And, you know, at its base level, that it elicits queer joy and that it elicits conversation and discourse about the importance of queer spaces and the importance of community. And also, I think the importance of having these conversations in both academic and contemporary spaces. I hope that people come into it and are able to relate to this idea of becoming, regardless of their own perspectives and what queer becoming might be or what this process is. But yeah, I hope that it opens up people's perspectives on both that And on a larger note, I hope that it opens up dialogues about how we can connect with plant life and with nature. I think that so much of this work was built around like our relationship to these plants that we grew and that we studied for a year. And so the show kind of opens with this land acknowledgement that we had written about being able to listen deeply to the world around you. And that also means listening to each other, but also to our environment and our communities. So I hope that it helps people kind of lock into that idea of listening and caring deeply about each other and about this world that we're in and the plant life that's on it and the people that are on it. Yes, and I hope people come and have a great time on like a more simple level. I hope that they enjoy it. I think they will enjoy it. People have said good things. So
that's always a primary consideration. The audience should have a good time, right?
I hope we'll have a good time.
Yes. Okay, is there anything else you think myself or the audience should know about ultraviolets?
I think come see it is my final thing I will say. This piece was just, it's a huge labor of love. It's taken, you know, so many people have come forward and helped make it happen. And so I'm really excited to share it for a second time in this way, away from SFU. Yeah, that's it. That's all I'd say.
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
Amazing. Thank you so much as well. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. My conversation with Alexandra Caprera. Ultraviolets is playing Thursday, November 21st and Friday, November 22nd at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media, which is 577 Great Northern Way. Up next, we'll hear my conversation with Teya Kasahara. He is the creator, co-creator, and star, lead actor in Eurydice Fragments, which is the feature performance at IndieFest. And that opens also at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media tomorrow, Friday, and runs Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Without further ado, here's Teya.
Hi, my name is Teya Kasahara. My pronouns are they and he. I'm a co-creator and also playing the role of O in Renaissance Opera's Eurydice Fragments.
Thanks for joining me today, Teya.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
I want to start by just talking a little bit about sort of who you are and how you come to all of this. In doing a little bit of research, you have an astounding volume, scope, and quality of work. From singing opera and other traditional and contemporary music to collaborating with Jeremy Dutcher to creating and performing in these innovative and boundary-pushing interdisciplinary theater works, I guess. It's hard to know exactly where to start. We can't talk about everything you've done because we would be here for days.
You're very kind.
But maybe can you let me and our listeners know how you come to making art and to singing and to all of this? Like, how does that happen, I guess?
Definitely. Good question. Yeah. Well, I went to UBC. That's where I studied music over 20 years ago. And I always loved music growing up. So that's what kind of just led me to this art form, like the extraordinary things you can do with the human voice. I think that's what really initially pulled me into opera. And I took the traditional path because that was primarily like what was available to me or what was offered. And in doing so, I just felt like I really struggled with who I was as a person and also coming into my queerness and then later my transness, and saw that adjacent art forms like theater, combining different art forms and creating new work is where I really started to find my own creative artistic foothold, so to speak. And for the past, I would say 9 or 10 years, that's where I started creating my own shows, but also collaborating with others who are doing this on an indie level and now large scale with all these different adjacent technologies that we have in the show that we're bringing to Vancouver.
Right. And I guess, you know, for anyone who is creating works that are new ways of thinking about the art form or different and not traditional, you're always, maybe not always, but it seems to be that you come up in that traditional system and then sort of recognize what those boundaries are or have those boundaries imposed on you or run into what they are. And then that shapes what you do from there to an extent, right?
I think so. Like, that was definitely the path that I took. And it provided a foundation. It provided a great understanding of like the historical context, the tradition, so to speak, like what I could do with my voice and what I could do with this art form. It's provided a container that I can push against and push through versus going the other way and just coming up with these ideas kind of more or less, I don't know, in a vacuum or from lack of experience.
Mm-hmm. Sort of have to know what you're subverting before you can subvert it to an extent.
Exactly. Exactly.
In that context, do you have a creative ethos or vision or like mission that you try to accomplish through all of your work?
I think if I had to boil it down to something, it would be about honesty or truth, whether that is the truth of the character that I'm creating or exploring, or being honest with myself, being honest and open with my co-collaborators or my co-creators about even having like trepidation about something or feeling like, you know, I have this sense of like, we shouldn't be doing this, quote unquote, you know? So I think bringing that honesty to the table is where I can start to unlearn some of maybe the harmful traditions that are still ingrained in me and where I can reprogram and put in new habits that are healthy and healing and coming from more of an abundance place, a place where new art can happen versus repeating old stuff that maybe keeps me locked in.
You mentioned earlier sort of coming into your queerness, coming into your transness. Has that shaped that desire to create newness and find a different space within the opera community?
Yeah, for sure. Like it's continues to be a process for me, figuring out who I am and also figuring out the kind of art that I want to be doing and the different stories that appeal to me right now. So it really feels like nothing is fixed, or it's like all of a sudden, oh, I've got it. This is the answer to my queerness, or this is the answer to my art. It doesn't feel like it's just a switch and I'm done. So as cliche as it sounds, like the journey has been wonderful and always giving just new ideas, new curiosities, a chance to take root. And I don't even really know exactly where, you know, the art will take me or where even I will feel a year from now or 5 years from now. But continually, I think following what feels right and following honesty feels the best for now.
Well, it sounds like discovery and intuition and, like you said, honesty is the big part of it. Can you put into words what art does for you, what making art, how it makes you feel or what it accomplishes for you?
Yeah, so much. I think it offers an arena for me to just express, a place to understand thoughts and feelings, emotions that I can't necessarily put words to. It offers a place where these thoughts can enter through my body and out of my body in a way that feels safe versus maybe, you know, doing something that like might hurt my body if like I go too hard at the gym or something like that, you know, or if I yell at someone on the street, I don't know, just like more extreme things. But through art, I feel like it is an arena basically, or a playground where those really difficult issues and difficult experiences have a place to become something else, to literally transform into something that we can share with my colleagues or with an audience, and hopefully they can also feel something from that and experience something.
And we're here today to talk about your latest work, which is Eurydice Fragments, which runs at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media November 15th to 17th. I've seen it described as a neoclassical transpunk electronic opera, which sounds pretty awesome. How would you describe the show?
That's a great tagline. Yeah, it is a lot of things. It is a new work. It combines opera, electronics, pop singing, soul, rock. We have four live musicians, and one of them is a beatboxer, a specialist with their voice to make sound effects. We have motion capture. We have virtual reality. There's projections. There's lighting. So, like, you're definitely going to hear opera singing, but you're going to hear so much more. You're going to see so much more. And the story is a story that like we've created like in the now, you know, in our 21st century, even though it is based on or inspired by the Orpheus and Eurydice ancient Greek myth. It's a co-creation. There's so many different types of people who have been involved, even in the development process, but in this final iteration, to create such a multi-layered work that has really taken root, I think, in all of our hearts.
You mentioned the sort of inspired by the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Why ancient Greece? Like, what about this particular story inspired you?
This myth has inspired many, many iterations. I think it's the most well-known story, even with like within the operatic canon, that there's, I don't know, hundreds of versions of this story. And I think what was really beautiful about this is that we saw the two characters of Orpheus and Eurydice as two parts of a whole. We saw them as kind of fractured selves of one person, and that our protagonist goes on this journey in order to recover parts of themselves that have been left behind or have fractured, and that we're not necessarily saying that transness is a journey for a person to reconcile themselves, but like any person, whether you're cisgender, transgender, whatever, that there are parts of ourselves that we might suppress or that we might not fully be honest about. And that hopefully this can inspire people to embrace all of who they are and to love all of who they are and to be able to feel safe enough to share that with the people that they do love.
You mentioned this is a work of collaboration co-created with Luke Hathaway. What can you tell me about Luke?
Luke is an amazing poet and writer. He's based out in Nova Scotia and also comes from trans experience. And so when we met a few years ago online, when Debbie Wong, the artistic director of Renaissance Opera, was asking me to be a part of this show, to play this character, the lead role, and also to come on as a co-creator for story, I just felt like this wonderful, instant warm connection about Luke. And he has such a beautiful way to sculpt words and to weave these poetic moments into our script, but also like very, very realistic scenes as well that just feel like, you know, you're just like in a narrative play. So it's wonderful to be able to bounce ideas off of multiple people versus just having, you know, one person dictate, this is how it must go and this is how you do it. So it's constantly even distilling in our rehearsal process right now. Like we're tweaking words a little bit here and there just to make it feel like it really lands and it really, yeah, just feels real to the specific actors who are playing these characters in our show.
So you're asked to come in and be the lead in the work and also co-create. Is that a familiar process to you, coming in and originating and creating this whole thing that you will be part of?
It's getting more and more familiar. I created my first show called The Queen and Me. I started that process about 7 years ago, and I'm the performer in that show as well. And it just feels like such a richer experience to be performing words that have come from your own being or that have come from, you know, a great brainstorm session with colleagues. It feels like the words and a role, like it goes in deeper into my body and I remember it more. I feel like I can bring my whole self to these kinds of projects because it's not just performing a certain type of like heteronormativity or a certain type of femininity in opera roles that are traditional, that are from the canon. So that's a great bonus for sure.
You mentioned earlier the dizzying number of elements in the show, that you've got beatboxing, you've got motion capture, you've got dance, vocal performance, all of this. I want to ask both how that comes together, like how you settle on all of that, but also I just did an interview with Alexandra Caprara, who is the director and creator of Ultraviolets, which is also playing as part of Indie Fest. And she mentioned that she creates with a design-led philosophy, where sort of the stage design and the other design of the play is really influencing the story and the overall creation of the play. Does that resonate with you?
Been a little bit more back and forth. Story has definitely designed where the technology is going in our show specifically. Mm-hmm. However, Renaissance Opera has been developing and collaborating with these technologies for about 5 to 7 years already now. And so earlier iterations of this show, like it was a video game just on its own, like maybe 10, 15 minute video game. And then it was an online virtual reality experience where the audience could pick where they wanted the character to go. this way or that way. And then a few years ago, we've had an iteration where you would see all the tech and you would see the singers. And I had a screen just in front of my face capturing my face, like when it was opening and closing as I was singing.